good to have you here. Thank you for joining us today, my friends. I'm Henrik from Götaland in Sweden, and this is Red Eyes Radio. You can hear us three times a week. We also produce videos, inside episodes, Radio 314. And we are starting up a live show video on June 4th, exclusive for RedEyesMembers.com, the site for subscribers and supporters. And this is going to be a weekly wrap-up show on many different topics that we are interested in and find it to be of utmost importance when it comes to our European identity and encouragement of our heritage, both with focus on the problems but also on the solutions. It's going to have many different themes and segments within the show. Also, by the way, I want to plug our t-shirts. We did make a batch exclusive for our first live show, our 10-year anniversary that we did about a month ago now, and we still have t-shirts available. They are organic, super comfy, and made by Lana's Llama. Very nice Red Eyes print on the front and text on the back. RedEyes.tv/store is where you can get yourself one. This is a great way to support us too, by the way, so definitely take a look if you haven't already. Well, today we're focusing on something more esoteric and spiritual in nature relating to technological advancements of Caucasians. We are going to frame our discussion today in a mythological context and talk about how to advance forward with success, with the past in mind, in order to balance and be conscious of the tremendous technological and scientific drive that the Indo-Aryan or the Indo-Europeans have had so far. Our guest to guide us through this discussion is Jason Reza Georgiani. He has a PhD, which of course makes him a doctor. He's a native New Yorker and Iranian American of Persian and Northern European descent. After receiving his BA and MA at New York University, he completed his doctorate in philosophy at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. Georgiani currently teaches science, technology, and society at the New Jersey Institute of Technology. He's the author of Prometheus and Atlas, which is the topic of our discussion here today. Dr. Georgiani is also a member of the Iranian Resistance Movement, by the way, and I hope to have him back in a future show to talk about this topic alone. It's a big topic and vastly fascinating in terms of what is happening in Iran these days. But next up here today is our discussion on Prometheus and Atlas. Welcome, Jason. It's a pleasure to have you here. Thank you so much for coming on with us.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Henrik.
Wonderful. Well, we had the opportunity to meet in New York on a couple of occasions a few months ago now, and we had some really interesting conversations about your work, about where we are really in general and what we need to do to start reversing the situation that we find ourselves in. And I'm really glad to have you on the show finally, Jason, and be able to both share your sharp mind with our audience and also, of course, talk more about your book, Prometheus and Atlas. So, as I said, I'm really looking forward to this. And I also want to mention, by the way, that I think you, just as me, have had an interest in parapsychology and metaphysics or the metaphysical, the nature of reality and all these other ideas and concepts that I guess many people today would dub fringe or whatever. But we've also seemed to have developed in our understanding of both politics and modernity as a whole, where our liberal society is going, including the aid of technology and science in that process, but also what the establishment are doing to us, trying to do to us. And I think we both have an appreciation for new ideas that seek to take us out of this situation. So I think this will be a lot of fun, Jason. But what do you think our audience should know about you and your background before we start going into the material in your book?
Well, probably the most noteworthy thing is that I've had a very interdisciplinary educational background, and I don't just mean within the confines of academia. From a relatively young age, even before I finished high school, I was very interested in the one hand on edge science, and in the other hand on in the various religious traditions of the world. So at some point I realized that the line of research commonly known as parapsychology was a bridge between the two of these. And I wound up exploring that in a more disciplined way through my graduate work. But I've studied subjects ranging from comparative religion and the history of philosophy to science and its impact on society, and also some studies of comparative cultures like the ancient history of Iran and its connection to the rest of the Indo-European world.
Yeah, a lot of things and a lot of overlaps, as I said, between our interests, basically, and everything from Rupert Sheldrake and Clive Baxter to, you know, all of these kinds of guys that are on the fringe but still very much well respected within, you know, they're bridging in the scientific world, really, but they're really on the fringe as well. So I really like that. Appreciate that.
Yeah, one of the most remarkable things that hopefully will come out in the course of this conversation is the way in which we followed largely parallel tracks in recognizing some of the more socio-political implications of these exotic developments in science and technology.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, should we do a quick overview, if we can, of your book, Jason? What is the essence of what the book is about, if you can?
Well, the book is, in essence, about a coming scientific revolution, but one that also promises to revolutionize society and politics. The idea of a scientific revolution that would move us beyond the Cartesian paradigm is one that's been thrown around for some time now. But the thesis of this text is that something far more radical than that is at stake in the evaluation of the evidence for things like extrasensory perception and psychokinesis. And one of the reasons why this scientific revolution has yet to take place is because there are very deeply entrenched social and political interests that are threatened by it. And in effect, we would have to imagine a new form of society in order to carry through this scientific revolution.
So we'll put that in perspective later and kind of how that fits into the larger picture, if you will. But I think we should begin speaking about the spectral revolution, and maybe we can define the terms a bit here and what you mean when you say a spectral, because I guess the word metaphysical or paranormal is not really something you like to use, right?
Well, I think they're misleading terms. I use them in order to deconstruct them. So let me say a few words about the term spectral, and then I'll come around to explaining how exactly I'm employing it in this concept of the spectral revolution. First of all, spectral suggests a spectrum, like the light spectrum, something that has degrees where there are no sharp distinctions between one quality and another. So it's a kind of confuting of binary oppositions, something that really undermines any attempt to draw sharp binary distinctions. Another obvious implication of the word spectral is the specter of things yet to come, what is on its way into being, becoming, as opposed to static being. And finally, what's most obviously related to the paranormal is specter in the sense of a ghost or a daemon. Specters. And I wind up employing the term spectral in all three of these senses.
Very good. Now, so bring us back to the spectral revolution, Jason.
Right. So as far back as the end of the 19th century, there were serious scientists in places like Cambridge and in the Northeast in Boston researching what they at that time widely referred to as psychical phenomena, things like clairvoyance and what they called telekinesis in those days. William James, who was one of the pioneers in this field, one of the greatest psychologists and philosophers of that time period, as early as 1909, came out and said that he thought that this body of evidence would affect the next scientific revolution, and he thought that this would take place in what he called the next generation. But in fact, that didn't happen. We had very sophisticated parapsychological research in the 1930s and 40s being carried out by people like J.B. Rhine. But this was very far from affecting a revolution in the scientific establishment as a whole. And in fact, over the two generations following that, up to our own time, we've yet to see a scientific revolution affected by an assessment of data from research on extrasensory perception and psychokinesis. So I asked the question at the very outset of my book, why is this the case? why is it that this spectral revolution is not the same as, say, the Copernican revolution or the Darwinian revolution? Why is it more than just another paradigm shift in the history of science?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I suggest it has to do with the inextricability of frameworks of knowledge from systems of power. We are inclined to think that when you ascertain knowledge about something, it has an objective validity that's neutral with respect to sociopolitical agendas. And that despite whatever obstacles, you might face in terms of getting institutions to support your research and so forth, eventually the truth will prevail, as it were, as if the truth were something value neutral. But in fact, I suggest that there's no such thing as a value neutral structure of knowledge. Every form of knowledge implies within itself a reorganization of political power. And the one that's in play here is more revolutionary than anything that we've seen so far in the history of science. It would demand a complete reorganization of our society. And I can give you some concrete examples of that if you'd like.
Yeah, definitely. Go ahead.
So if we look at some of the most impressive psychical research that's been done, some of the most impressive research in parapsychology on what they call PSI. This is PSI. This is their sort of amalgamated term for ESP or extrasensory perception and psychokinesis. If we look at some of the most impressive PSI research, we can see very quickly how if it were to gain mainstream recognition, it would have a very destabilizing effect on society. So, for example, the CIA funded some research at the Stanford Research Institute, SRI, beginning in the 1970s on what they referred to as remote viewing. Essentially, this was a methodology for using clairvoyance in order to be able to see distant locations, like, for example, classified Soviet military facilities, and sketch schematics of them, see what was going on inside them. And this program was eventually acquired by the Department of Defense. It continued to receive U.S. government funding all the way from the 1970s through the 1980s up till the end of the Cold War. In addition to clairvoyantly viewing classified facilities, clandestine facilities, the remote viewers at times were asked to access the minds of various political leaders, like, for example, Saddam Hussein, and ascertain their intentions. So it also involved, in certain cases, the use of telepathy. Well, if you let me mention one last thing before I draw out the social implications of this. They were able to look a few days into the future as well in certain cases. Actually, this was a drawback at first. They were trying to get their remote viewers to focus on a distant location and provide them with a schematic of it. And they noticed that the operator would sometimes slip backwards or forwards in time and give them a view of the site at some moment other than the present. And while this was a bottleneck at first, they saw that it actually offered them another kind of capability, which eventually they used to track hostages. When Hezbollah took American hostages, they were able to coordinate rescue operations by tracking the movement of the hostage several days into the future. Okay, so now just let's stay with that for a moment and look at the social implications here. If indeed you can clairvoyantly, you can teach people, okay, in a disciplined manner, if you can train them reliably to view remote locations, well, essentially, you've lost your personal privacy. Anyone who is trained in this kind of ability would be able to see you do anything in the most private space that you could imagine.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
There goes personal privacy, and frankly, there goes any kind of state secrecy, which is really the foundation of national security. So that's a very significant social implication. Perhaps even more disturbing than that is the idea that somebody could be accessing your subconscious intentions and reading thoughts from out of your mind. So it's not just the question of spatial privacy, but the privacy of your thoughts.
Right.
So, and then when you think about the implications of the precognitive abilities that they were able to use, say in organizing hostage rescue operations, who really wants to look into their own future? I mean, people very casually think that that would be a great thing, but do you really want to see all the triumphs and tragedies that you're going to endure throughout the course of your life? And maybe these are only possible futures, and you'd be able to avert some of the more disastrous events in your life. But would you also have the same motivation to accomplish some of the most wonderful things that you are yet to live through?
Mm-hmm.
Would right. seeing your own future destroy your ability to actualize it in some way?
Yeah.
And more seriously than that, the implication is that we would live in a society where it was possible to see crimes before they were committed. And, you can't really imagine a worse form of thought policing than to have people be arrested for crimes that they have yet to commit but are very likely to, especially violent crimes or acts of terrorism.
Yeah, the stock market, business secrets, all these things would be in jeopardy, basically.
That's right. I mean, you could have companies steal patents before they've been properly worked out. There has been some issue with viewing numbers, remote viewing numbers. It's notoriously difficult, but they've come up with a protocol, which I don't want to go into in detail right now, but basically that allows you to predict the rise and fall of corporations without looking at numbers actually going up and down on the stock market. It involves correlating future events to very vivid symbols and viewing those rather than the event itself,
right.
rather than a stock itself. So
to clarify here a little bit, Jason, the opposition, if you will, to the various psi phenomena has not been because it doesn't work or isn't real or anything like that, but the acceptance of it would actually be too destructive to our societal and social structures, really.
Yeah, let me give you an even more... terrifying example of that, which really leaves no doubt as to what the problem here is, at least on an unconscious level, with processing this data. Psychokinesis, or what they used to call telekinesis, the ability to affect the physical world with intention alone. At the Princeton Engineering Anomalies Laboratory, this is at Princeton University, the dean of the School of Engineering and Applied Sciences there, beginning in the late 1970s, ran a program that was focused on trying to get people to affect the output of a random number generator with intention alone. These random number generators are hooked to a computer, and they're genuinely random. They translate something like the decay rate of radioactive material into an output on a computer screen. And this is it's statistically random. So you have these people sitting in front of the computer screen, and they try to alter what would be the output on the screen. They try to skew it above or below the parameters that it would have if it were left to itself. And this guy, John, and his team produced a mountain of data, with astronomical odds against chance, showing that this is possible for basically anybody to do, for the average person to do. And while it may not seem like a big deal to affect something on such a micro level, one has to remember that this has significant implications, say, in designing quantum computers, any kind of a very micro electronic equipment like what's used in jet fighter cockpits would be vulnerable to this kind of thing. So one of the things I believe that piqued John's interest, because he was an aerospace engineer, was this phenomenon known as the gremlin effect, where you have systems inside airplane cockpits, especially jet fighter cockpits, fail repeatedly, and there's no discernible cause. So in the aerospace industry, they've built multiple levels of redundancy into these systems, because it tends to be the case that when pilots freak out in their cockpits, their electronic systems fail. And they've also noticed this with computer systems, that if you have someone suddenly throw a temper tantrum in the vicinity of a computer, it tends to go haywire or may even crash.
I've experienced that many times, to be honest.
Yeah, I think it's a relatively common experience, actually.
Yeah. Oh, my God. In the worst times, too, computers fail, and, you know, it's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. And I've always wondered, there has to be some kind of, obviously, exchange here between me and the computer, you know. So.
Right. So this is also true of affecting organic systems. There have been methods developed, techniques of focused visualization and directed intention developed for healing diseases that affect the human organism. They call this direct mental interaction with living systems. And the focus is always on psychic healing. But what these people don't like to talk about is that you could use the very same techniques to cause somebody's brain activity to go haywire or stop their heart. So, you know, that's very serious. And someone who's pointed at this is Dr. Stephen Browdy, who used to be the chair of the Department of Philosophy at the University of Maryland, Baltimore, and was also a past president of the Parapsychological Association. He has noted that subconscious fear of that kind of use of these capabilities probably explains a lot about the resistance to psi research. And one of the reasons he's so aware of that, so keenly aware of that, is he has done very good work sifting through the early studies of physical mediumship from the late 19th into the early 20th century, cases where people like Sir William Crookes, prominent scientists of the time, witnessed table tilting or levitations or productions of ectoplasm by some of these early mediums, some of the ones who turned out not to be charlatans. And if these capabilities are veridical, then, you know, we do live in a world where it is possible to kill with your thoughts.
Yeah, it's amazing. So the ridicule, if you will, of this field has really been to protect against it, right, as a way to keep it out, to keep most people away from it. Because what kind of shift, if you will, would this be, or a revolution, if we did open the door to all of this? Would we be ready for a paradigm shift like that?
That's right. And see, I don't think it's entirely conscious either. I think that, first of all, the greatest damage that could ensue could itself be unconscious. In other words, it's been found throughout the history of psi research that the more unconscious the intention is, the more efficacious it is. So the real danger is not necessarily that you would wish harm on somebody consciously, but what would happen if people were aware that their unconscious intentions were being translated into effects in the physical world, including effects on other people. So by the same token, I think that the resistance to mainstream acknowledgement of the evidence produced by parapsychological research is unconsciously acting to inhibit the abilities themselves. There's something in psi research known as the psi inhibitor effect, or negative psi effect. And this is where you have a study that's been carried out many times, testing ESP or psychokinesis. And you have very good replication of this study at a certain laboratory. And then someone who's a notorious skeptic comes and is physically present on the site, and the replication fails. And the suggestion is that this person is actually having a negative psi effect to inhibit the phenomenon out of some kind of unconscious fear. It may be that on a societal scale, that dam or levee is in effect. And if we were to have a mainstream acknowledgement of these abilities, that dam would give way, and we'd actually see on a regular basis much more dramatic displays of psi.
Interesting. Now, is there focus here on technology over science? I mean, SRI, for example, that you mentioned earlier, while they claim that programs such as the remote viewing projects has been canceled more or less, and of course you have people like Russell Targ and Hal Puthoff behind this, but I've noticed that SRI has a number of subsidiaries these days which focus on artificial intelligence and augmentation research and these kinds of areas. Is there a favorability on technology over science?
Well, that's an interesting question because it brings us really to the heart of the more philosophical implications of this situation. And that's the relationship between technology and science. People often don't think of the development of psychic ability as a technology. But
right.
in fact, it is. And in the Greek sense of technology, the word that we get technology from in Greek is technē, which means craft. Development of psychic ability is not only a technology, it also tells us something more profound about the relationship between science and technology. People are inclined to think of technology as applied theoretical science. And one of the reasons why parapsychologists themselves, I think, have had such a hard time moving beyond the Cartesian paradigm is that they expect there will be some new theoretical model that will accommodate this data. And I think that they're going about it the wrong way. The other thing that I should mention is, in order to work in that vein, they often have to disregard some very large body of evidence. They try to say, for example, that psychokinesis only operates on the quantum level, so as to come up with a new theory from out of quantum physics that's going to accommodate all of the psi data. It always involves marginalizing some body of evidence. And if you look at the whole mass of psi research data that's been produced through competent methodology, you come to the conclusion that there is no theoretical model that's going to be able to accommodate all of this data. And what that tells you is that scientific theories are in fact models. They are not representations of nature. It's not as if these are mirrors that are reflecting objective structures in nature. Scientific theories allow us to get a better handle on the world. So the most significant philosophical implication, or let's say the most significant implication of the spectral revolution with respect to a theory of knowledge, is that it gives us an insight into the fact that technology is more fundamental than science. Scientific theories are produced by a way of being. The science is a human behavior. And long before we had theoretical science, we were engaged in technological engineering. And in fact, there's not a single avenue of scientific research that you can pursue without technology as a prerequisite. Even geometry. You need basic tools to do geometry.
Right.
So we've been looking at the relationship between science and technology backwards. Theoretical science serves technological purposes, and man is a technological being.
Yeah. It's really interesting. I really like that discussion that you have in terms of the of trying to understand the nature of reality and also seeking objectivity and real, you know, answers, because however we try, right, we are confined within, as you say, a model, or we're limited in the way that we can include, you know, our senses, if you will, to try to, or instruments even, to measure reality, right? No matter how much we try, there's always going to be elements of nature that we can't quite get to. Isn't that right?
Exactly. So you mentioned senses and also nature. Our primordial experience of the world was, and in some cases still is, an instinctual one. You know, our animal ancestors experience a world of meaningful things in places, not a world of objects in space-time. So this relationship that we have to things as composite objects that can be deconstructed in a grid of space-time, that is an overlay of a more primordial relationship to the world in terms of meaningful things and places. And this is why, for example, if, say, an animal gets lost across country, say you have a pet that you lose when you're on vacation to California, and it's somehow able to find its way all the way across country back to the door of your house in the New York countryside. This is why it's able to do so, because it doesn't experience the territory of North America in terms of an abstract grid of space.
Right.
It's pulled back to where it belongs because of the significance that its dwelling place has to it. And so, you know, the psi evidence, the evidence for ESP and psychokinesis, is only anomalous because we have convinced ourselves that we live in a world of discrete objects inside some kind of abstract spatial grid. Whereas, you know, these abilities are perfectly natural to animals. You have many studies of telepathy and clairvoyance in animals that, for example, Rupert Sheldrake has done a great job of bringing together.
Yes.
So in fact, if anything, our ESP is atrophied by comparison to theirs, and atrophied largely because we have hyper-developed our technical intellect and developed a kind of objectified relationship to things.
Right. I was just going to say that isn't the technology that we've developed a kind of a way to make up for this lost ability? I mean, some people see it that, well, we've lost it because we're lost ourselves in technology. Another part is that, no, we developed the need for technology because those abilities was something that was, I don't know, disappearing from us. We were not connecting with them anymore. What do you think?
Right. I think that that's quite possible, that there was a change in our cognitive structure. But I also think, and in this respect, I agree with Bergson, whose work I draw on in Prometheus and Atlas, I think that there's going to be another phase in this developmental process where we regain what was once our instinct in terms of a cultivated intuition. And that would really be extraordinary, because, see, animals don't have the kind of handle on the world that we do. They don't have a technical relationship to their environment. So it's one thing for them to have ESP. It's another thing for that to be combined with the grasp on things that humans do have. So, but let me go back for a minute to this idea of nature as it's experienced before technology, because the key to my concept of the spectral revolution is that actually the most haunting thing in the world is the way in which our technological mode of being has covered over nature as it's encountered by animals, or let's say, by even primitive tribes. Just a brief note on that. It's not just animals who have psychic abilities that in most cases are extraordinary by comparison to ours. If you go into parts of the world that are relatively untouched by technology, like, for example, if you read some of the accounts that the British had with Australian Aborigines back maybe a century or so, you'll see that these groups of people also have the similar clairvoyant capabilities as some non-human animals have. For example, the Australian Aborigines are able to organize victory celebrations for a hunt long before their hunting party has returned. They will sit around depressed if the hunt has been unsuccessful, and on the other hand, if it's been successful, the hunting party comes back to the base camp with a celebration ready for them. And the British asked the Aborigines what was going on here, and they said, you see, you have a telegraph, we have a telegraph here, and they tapped their chests. So the primordial relationship to nature reveals that it's not what our scientific theories have framed it as. And so then the question that you're left with is, how is it that our mechanistic, materialistic scientific theories and the kinds of technology that we pattern on the basis of them, how is it that these are so successful if, in fact, nature is, let's say, more chaotic and more dynamic? And the conclusion that I reach is that anticipatory projection, wanting to see ahead, wanting to be able to project the future so that you can plan for it, and world modeling, being able to develop maps or atlases of reality, again, for practical purposes, these are, in a sense, demonic forces that through us have been structuring nature to have a kind of stability that it doesn't have for non-human animals or for groups of people who are essentially pre-technological.
Yeah, those are very interesting. You know, we'll put this understanding in context later, too, and why this is kind of important in the bigger picture of the problems we're facing. But I wanted to start speaking more about Prometheus and Atlas, what these archetypes, what they are and how they drive our development unconsciously. But before we go there, Jason, is there anything else you want to say about the spectral revolution before we go to those archetypes?
No, I think it's fine for us to make that transition now, because what I'm what I was essentially suggesting is that specters are at work in our scientific theorizing. They are essentially ordering nature in a way that we are able to then read back out of the world the kind of measurable order and stability that we have built into it in the first place through our modeling activities. And so this, I think, is the activity of what I identify as the specters of Prometheus and Atlas, that are kind of demonically possessing at least a certain form of human life and giving it the power to colonize the world through the advance of technological science.
Tell us a bit more about what properties these have and the way that they have shaped us of who we are today.
So I mentioned anticipatory projection, which is just a way of saying that technological science essentially is interested in giving us a view ahead, in developing projections so that we can plan adequately for the future. This is at the core of the archetype of Prometheus. In Greek mythology, Prometheus is actually the creator of the human race, not Zeus. We were supposedly created in the image of Prometheus. And Zeus didn't take very kindly to this, because he saw the potential for the rise of a rival race of gods. So he essentially subjects human beings to conditions of ignorance and consequently servitude to the Olympians. In order to remedy this situation, Prometheus steals fire from Olympus and brings it to the realm of mortals. And I suggest that this fire is both emblematic of the light of knowledge and also the fire of the forge, the key to all technological development. So it was Prometheus's intention to allow us to stand on our own two feet and come into the destiny that he promised us by crafting us in his own titanic image. The name Prometheus in Greek means forethought, or prevision, to think ahead. It has the same root as mathemata. In Greek, the root of the word mathematics, which of course is the key to all kinds of scientific theorizing, has to do with the idea of the always already known, knowing something about things that you don't know anything about yet. In other words, the idea of developing a net that you can throw over anything that you don't know yet, some context that you can frame it in terms of. So mathematics doesn't necessarily have to do with knowledge. Even biological theories that view a certain phenomenon that you're studying in the organic world with respect to some fixed framework are mathematical in the Greek sense. And so it's not at all incidental that this word is also in the name of Prometheus. The root of the word mathemata is also in the name of Prometheus. The other thing about this myth that's significant in that regard is that Zeus punishes Prometheus for this act of sedition by chaining him to a mountain in the Caucasus, by chaining him to one of the peaks of the Caucasus mountain range. The Caucasus is a very cold and brutal part of the world, at any rate up in the mountains. And so it also suggests that Prometheus is the god of people who had to use craft in order to adapt to adverse environmental conditions. He's the god of the Caucasians.
Right.
So I think these are all elements in the mythos of Prometheus that have to do with the idea of anticipatory projection. And a little later on, maybe when we get to talking about Atlas, I can say something about the fact that Prometheus is a Titan and who the Titans are in relation to the gods. And, you know, what is it at the root of this rebellion of Prometheus against the world order of Olympus?
Right. That's I've always been fascinated with the myth of Prometheus as he's seen, obviously, as a kind of a liberator of humanity. He gives them the tools to kind of take themselves out of ignorance to a certain extent. But as you say, he's punished by this, and he even has his, what is it, liver eaten. Is it once every day an eagle comes and picks at it, right?
Yeah, and I'll tell you why it's the liver. It's actually terribly significant. The Greeks, the archaic Greeks, used to use the liver for fortune telling. Liver is very dark, and they had a practice of soothsaying or fortune telling by looking at the liver sort of like at night by candlelight or the reflection of stars in the liver and so forth. Basically, tea leaf reading, okay? Not very important as a practice, but it's important as a symbol. In other words, this is a way of saying that Zeus has the eagle pecking at Prometheus's power to see the future. And the reason he's doing this is because Prometheus knows who is going to overthrow Zeus. So this is really important because in Greek mythology, first of all, it's often believed that the Greeks were fatalists, that they thought everything was governed by fate. And they often equated this inexorable fate with the mind of Zeus. What the myth of Prometheus shows is that somebody knows better than Zeus.
Right.
And this somebody, and Zeus, so Zeus is not omnipotent. Rather, he's not omniscient. He's not obviously not omnipotent either. But he's not omniscient. And it's very significant that the guy who knows better than Zeus is the father of humanity, who created man in his own image. So this is a way that the Greek mind was grasping toward the idea of free will and human self-determination.
Yeah.
And the tragedy of Prometheus is that he is being punished for imagining a better world.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't help to see some kind of demiurge overlap with some of the Semitic traditions and what we get in the Bible, but we'll talk more about that later. It's a huge topic there. What about Atlas then? How does he fit into this picture as an archetype in all of this?
Well, let me just say a couple more things about Prometheus before we get to Atlas. You know, Frankenstein, probably one of the most bastardized tales of the 20th century with all of these second and third rate film adaptations. Frankenstein was alternately titled by Mary Shelley, The Modern Prometheus. And in fact, her husband had also written a play about Prometheus entitled Prometheus Unbound. Before saying a few words about Frankenstein, let me just note that in this play, Percy Shelley really radicalizes the Prometheus myth by changing its ending. You know, although that myth does reach toward the idea of free will, the Greeks were such fatalists that in the third installment of Aeschylus's Prometheus trilogy, he does wind up having to stage a reconciliation of Prometheus with Zeus. But Shelley, Percy Shelley, changes this ending so that there's no reconciliation. And one of the curious things about his play is that he uses all of the Latin names for the classical European deities. So instead of, say, Hermes, he'll say Mercury, or he'll have Jupiter instead of Zeus, and so forth. But not in the case of Prometheus. And I think that this is because if he were to translate Prometheus into Latin, he would have to use the word Lucifer.
Mm, right.
His Prometheus really starts to become Lucifer, and we see this in his wife's novel as well, where the creature, Dr. Frankenstein's creature, profoundly identifies with Lucifer in Milton's Paradise Lost. And this takes on another meaning when you carefully read the novel and recognize that on a certain metaphorical level, at any rate, the creature is a specter of the creator himself. He's an exteriorization of the creator's own titanic genius. So in a way, Dr. Frankenstein is Lucifer. And he's also a Renaissance man. I mean, this is a guy who epitomizes the integral, interdisciplinary unity of knowledge that was characteristic of classical science and that was reborn in the European Renaissance, and that was very open to what we now call the paranormal. Dr. Frankenstein's an alchemist, and a great deal is made of the fact that his establishment, early modern scientific teachers, find his interest in the occult and occult philosophers laughable, and they try to enlighten him. But at any rate, this is also an important development of the Prometheus mythos closer to our own time, and one that highlights the way in which Prometheus is one of the archetypes of the spirit of exploration and discovery that defines technological science. One way you see that in Frankenstein is in terms of this frame story. Really, Frankenstein is a story within a story. The frame story is about a journey of exploration, charting a path to the North Pole, a seagoing voyage cutting through the ice toward the North Pole. And the relationship between Dr. Frankenstein and the captain of this ship, who's a kind of Magellan or Columbus-like figure, draws a connection between Frankenstein's researches in the laboratory and the spirit of European explorers and discoverers in general.
Very interesting. And, you know, Mary Shelley, of course, very, very interesting works in terms of how, you know, they tie in Prometheus, there's a myth into other aspects of the work, but he, you know, it's more than that. You have Goethe wrote about this. You have Nietzsche, and you go through a lot of this in the book as well, right?
I do. You know, it might be worth just mentioning Nietzsche briefly. In The Birth of Tragedy, his earliest and I think one of his greatest works, he explicitly contrasts the Prometheus myth with the Semitic myth of the creation in Genesis. And he holds up Prometheus as the prototype of Aryan man, that somehow Prometheus exemplifies the qualities of the Aryan spirit more than any other sacred symbol.
Yeah, so there's something to that. That's interesting, the Prometheus myth versus the Semitic Genesis. It's does this pit the Promethean spirit and aspect as something which is like the Antichrist in nature, if you look at this from a Christian perspective?
Well, yeah. I mean, essentially, what Nietzsche recognized and what I agree with is that Prometheus is the serpent in the Garden of Eden. He is the wisdom god who is offering knowledge and the power that ensues from knowledge to mankind. And, you know, if you remember in the Eden story, the serpent tells Adam and Eve, this God is a liar. if you eat from this tree, you're going to be enlightened. And if you eat from the other one, you're going to have immortal life. And the only reason this God doesn't want you to do these things is because he wants to lord over you. And it's very clear in the Genesis story that the reason man is banished from Eden after having eaten of the tree of knowledge is that if we were to also go and eat of the tree of life, which I think is somehow metaphorical of the key to at least a longer life than the one we have, this God would be powerless with respect to us. We would have an equal footing with him. So, and then if you follow it through the way Nietzsche does, what does this God do after we build up a powerful civilization on the earth? He floods it, fear that we are, again, going on a path to rival the gods in knowledge and power. And you see this as well in the story of the Tower of Babel, where a unified human civilization with a single language and unity of purpose is basically scattered to the winds, has their thinking and their language confused, and they're divided into tribes and set against one another in a long series of destructive wars. So divide and conquer so as to not let the children, understand what you do.
Yeah, get somewhere, basically. Yeah. You mentioned, of course, the relations to the Caucasus, that he's chained to the one of the mountains, one of the peaks at the Caucasus. Is there a specific relationship here between Prometheus and what Nietzsche wrote about in relation to, like, the Aryan man, basically?
I think that he's seeing in the industriousness of the Prometheus archetype, in its will to self-determination and self-responsibility, in its unconditional quest for knowledge, in its willingness to know at any cost, the essential features of all of the great Indo-European or Aryan civilizations. And one thing that I point to in my book is the relationship between Prometheus and the god of the Persians in particular, because you see Prometheus rise to this degree of prominence within Greek mythology in the context of the new art form of tragedy only during and after the Persian colonization of Greece. And I think it's not accidental that the god of the Persians, Ahura Mazda, the titan of wisdom, has all of the same essential attributes as Prometheus. He is also a god symbolized by fire, and his primary, attribute or main quality is Spenta Mainu, which translates as the progressive or forward-thinking mentality. So,
right.
So you have this connection, and Nietzsche, of course, was the author of Thus Spoke Zarathustra. He was one of the great early German scholars of ancient Iranian culture. Very much venerated the Persians. In fact, he goes so far as to say that he wished the Persians had successfully colonized Greece, so that Persia, rather than Rome, would have become the conduit of the continuation and elaboration of the Greek heritage.
Right.
So, I think he saw that it's not just a question of this isolated Greek figure of Prometheus. It's that in the Prometheus myth, we see something that's true on an archetypal level about the Aryan community of nations as a whole.
Right, very, very interesting, And then, of course, you have the Faustian aspect to all of this, kind of weaved into the story as well. I mean, we get this archetype, right, that comes through in so many different stories and so many different characters. It embodies the same essence, and it's really an archetype which has properties that we have within ourselves, right? And that's why it keeps coming out now and then in one way or another.
Yeah, Goethe, who wrote Faust, confesses, he also wrote a poem about Prometheus, and he confesses that in the most lonely and desperate period of his life, he embraced Prometheus essentially as his personal god. So this is very telling whenever we, you know, we have people often in the new right embrace the idea of Western civilization as a Faustian civilization.
Mm-hmm.
They ought to remember that the man who coined the Faustian as a concept viewed Prometheus as his personal god and
right.
Mentor.
Yeah. Well, very interesting. Well, we could just talk forever about Prometheus and some of those things. Should we talk a bit about Atlas?
Yeah, let's. So Atlas is the brother of Prometheus. He is, according to Greek mythology, the brother of Prometheus. You often see them depicted together on, say, Greek vase paintings or dishes and so forth. He's very closely connected to Prometheus in the sense that he was also doled out a terrible punishment by Zeus and for essentially the same crime. The very name Atlas means to bear. And what he's bearing is the punishment of holding the celestial sphere on his shoulders. People often confuse this. They think that Atlas is holding up the earth. That's not the case. The sphere that Atlas is bearing up on his shoulders is the celestial sphere, like a star globe. And this is significant because ancient mariners used to use star charts to navigate the oceans and open up uncharted territories. So this is where we get the use of Atlas for any kind of map or chart, or even in biology and medicine, they have atlases of the human body, which are those old models of the different strata of the human body. Some of them just show the blood vessels, and some of them have the skeletal system and so forth. So an atlas is any kind of chart, map, or model. And I connect this to the world modeling activity of technological science. So technological science is about developing atlases of the world. The myth of Atlas, the first time that we encounter this in a developed form, is in Plato's dialogues Timaeus and Critias. And you mentioned the Demiurge earlier. It's interesting that in Timaeus, Plato has this vision of a world-building god that uses templates, geometric templates, in order to form chaotic matter into the rule-governed world that we live in. And it's in the Timaeus dialogue that he introduces the story of Atlas, and then it continues in the subsequent dialogue, Critias. So I actually think that there's a connection between this world-modeling god in Timaeus and Atlas, the king of Atlantis. So according to Plato, the civilization of Atlantis was governed by Atlas. Atlantis actually just means the realm of Atlas. And this was a vast island continent that had civilization established on it by the god Poseidon. And Atlas is the eldest son of Poseidon. Actually, Plato tells us that this is a collection of islands. But together, they form a landmass about comparable in size to the continental United States. He says the size of Asia and Libya combined, and if you look at what that meant for the Greeks, it's something about the size of the continental United States. And he says that this island continent is in the middle of the one true ocean, which is also quite a curious phrase because, in fact, if you think about it, we do have one true ocean on the Earth, the place where the Atlantic and the Pacific and Indian Oceans meet, the coast around Antarctica. So people often think about Atlantis as being situated between Europe and the Americas, but all he tells us is that it's outside the Pillars of Hercules. In other words, it's beyond the Strait of Gibraltar. It's outside the Mediterranean somewhere. And it is where there's one true ocean. And he also interestingly notes that you could pass from one side of the earth to the other, by basically island hopping through Atlantis. At any rate, Atlas is the king of Atlantis, and the reason that he is punished by Zeus, just the way that his brother Prometheus is that the Atlantean civilization arose through a hybridization of gods and mortals. And over time, they became increasingly rebellious and bent on self-determination, to the point where eventually you have what could be described as a very humanistic civilization, one that doesn't see any need for servile reverence of heavenly gods. And so the Atlanteans set out to unify the entire planet under their own world order in disregard of the Olympians. Plato describes this as a very technically advanced civilization. He essentially draws together all of the technical marvels of his own time and depicts Atlantis as, you know, what we could probably describe as the first science fictional society. And so this empire consolidates control over the world to the point where the Olympians basically can't tolerate this, and Zeus calls together a convocation of the gods and decides to flood the earth and destroy the Atlanteans. So we have in this a parallel also to the story of the great flood in the Bible, story of the flood of Noah.
Yeah, it all comes through there. Now, there's others that have, many other philosophers and thinkers that have written about Atlantis in various ways, from Bacon to Steiner, even actually one of our old guests, Colin Wilson. Tell us a bit about these, what they wrote when it comes to Atlantis.
So Francis Bacon writes a book called The New Atlantis, and interestingly, he leaves it unfinished on his desk, which is strange because Plato does the same thing. Plato actually emphatically insists that he did not make up the Atlantis story. He repeatedly says that this is a true story that was a family heirloom that initially came from Solon, the lawmaker of Athens, and you know that he is basically telling it like it is. At any rate, he never finishes this, and neither does Sir Francis Bacon, one of the founders of modern science. But in what we have of the New Atlantis, we essentially are given an account of what you could call a breakaway civilization, a group of people who've isolated themselves on an island somewhere and are scientist inventor types who are drawing from all of the innovations of various cultures in order to synthesize them and make scientific breakthroughs that would otherwise not be possible. Instead of statues of gods, they have statues of inventors at sacred places on their island. He envisions all kinds of incredible things for that time period: skyscrapers, lasers, basically holographic manipulations. He says that the citizens of the New Atlantis manufacture robots or automatons for various purposes. He really emphasizes that dimension of Plato's account of Atlantis that has to do with mechanical engineering and what we think of as the development of hard technology. But there's also more significantly, more, you know, at a deeper level, this idea that one has to have a stewardship over technological development with a view to what society is ready for. The aristocracy that governs the New Atlantis carefully evaluates whether the public, even on the island itself, is ready for one or another technological innovation before releasing it publicly. And of course, with respect to the rest of the world, they are an occulted or hidden society. So this highlights the fact that the acquisition of knowledge and innovation on that basis is really inextricable from the mechanisms of power that govern a society, and that certain breakthroughs in science could be terribly destabilizing from a social perspective. Of course, the one that we began talking about is the, you know, breakthrough in psychical research. and the catastrophic impact that that could have on our society. Which is interesting because Rudolf Steiner, another person who develops the mythos of Atlantis, focuses more on the psychical abilities of the Atlanteans. Plato, again, saw the Atlanteans as hybrids of gods and mortals, and part of this sort of demigod status that they had was they were in possession of certain miraculous or superhuman mental capabilities. Steiner really plays this up. And his Legend of Atlantis is also a tragedy insofar as what begins as a very ecologically aware society in harmony with nature winds up one being destroyed through the misuse of psychic abilities. And so in that sense, it's also a cautionary tale about the spectral revolution.
Yeah, very interesting. What about Colin Wilson?
So I actually excised the part of my book that presented Colin Wilson's research, and I'll tell you why I did in a few moments. It's ultimately because I wanted to use the mythos of Atlantis, the archetype of Atlas, to make an argument about the inextricability of technological scientific development from world colonization, from colonialism, and the integration of the world under a single order. So for that purpose, I didn't want the emphasis to shift onto the question of whether Atlantis existed, you know, empirically speaking, as some actual society in the human past.
Right.
But at one point I did have some of the research of Colin Wilson in there, where basically this philosopher has synthesized research on ancient Egypt, on curiosities about the geology of the Sphinx and the positioning of the pyramids, as well as certain features of structures in the Andes Mountains that and various other sites that point to the fact that we once had a global maritime civilization that was shattered by some kind of geological catastrophe, and that survivors of it went around essentially seeding the various world historical civilizations in what people call their cradles. And so this is also relevant to the idea of the civilizing mission of Prometheus. Colin Wilson speculates that Atlantis is a kind of root civilization of the Earth, and that with respect to more primitive peoples, with respect to relatively undeveloped tribes in various parts of the Earth, these Atlanteans were essentially civilizer gods. One of the most interesting cases of this is in the Andes and South America, from the Andes and South America all the way up through Mexico, where we have the legend of Quetzalcoatl, who's sometimes also referred to as Viracocha, or interestingly, Votan. And I've always wondered whether this Votan reference somehow relates to Wotan or Odin.
Yep.
At any rate, he's described as a tall, fair-skinned, basically white fellow with a long flowing beard. And, you know, you just don't get those phenotypic features in South America.
Right.
In fact, they're fairly specific. And the Edfu texts in Egypt that describe how the builder gods laid the ground for that civilization, they evoke a similar image of these people who came across the ocean in order to rebuild some shadow of their lost world. So Colin Wilson talks about how, you know, research by Robert Schock and others show that, geologically speaking, the Sphinx could not have been built by the Egyptians, that it's much, much older, and he refers to Robert Bovall's analysis of the Giza pyramids being a reflection of the stars of Orion's belt, and how if you match these up in a way where the stars of Orion's belt are in the same orientation to the Milky Way as the three Giza pyramids are to the Nile River as a representation of the Milky Way, And then if you consider the fact that at dawn on the spring equinox in 10,500 BC, the Sphinx is looking at the constellation of Leo, or rather at the sun rising up into the constellation of Leo, its counterpart. This points to the fact that Plato was right when he said that Atlantis was a civilization that reached its zenith some 9,000 years before his time, which would make it about 12,000 or 12,500 years before our own epoch.
I think we should point out too, Jason, that much of these finds and if you will, even some of these what seems to be calendar systems that points to a specific time comes largely out of nowhere, right? There hasn't been signs of much of this before, and then all of a sudden you get these, you know, incredible monuments, if you will, in various places, almost like there has been a diaspora, if you will, from a central location, and they've gone to many different places around the globe, right?
Yeah, I mean, let's be frank. The Mayan calendar has the accuracy of a computer, and the people who purportedly developed it couldn't grasp the concept of the wheel.
Right.
They had children's toys with wheels on them, but they didn't understand that this could be used for transportation. So this doesn't compute. Okay, so I think somebody gave them this knowledge. And on the other hand, I think that sometimes there's too much of a leap made into, you know, something like an ancient astronaut hypothesis, or, you know, it was aliens or whatever.
Sure.
We do a disservice to our own human past by leaping to such conclusions.
Yes.
I think we may be covering over something about who we are and what our true heritage is when we, don't think carefully about where that kind of knowledge could have come from. And what it expresses on an archetypal level, what is the ethos here behind such a civilization? I think it's a Promethean ethos.
Yeah, very good point. Now, let's talk a bit more here about this Atlantic civilization and you know, this idea of cosmopolitan. We're going to take a break here shortly, but I want to squeeze that in here before we do take a break. And another question, too, I want to ask you about that, but tell us a bit more about that, what it means to be one of these cosmopolitans.
Right. So this is, I think, among your audience at any rate, what I'll probably get the most flack for, the use of this term cosmopolitan. And it's important to point out what this really means. Cosmopolitan does not mean throwing a whole bunch of people together and developing a heterogeneous society that has no identity whatsoever, that becomes a stew or melting pot, where nothing has any discernible character. Okay. Cosmopolitan in Greek means citizen of the cosmos. It's from the roots cosmos or universe and polis or city-state. So to be a cosmopolitan already means something very definite. It means being able to transcend tribalism and the limited outlooks of one particular culture, being able to think beyond custom, to not be bound by unreflective adherence to tradition. So unreflective adherence to tradition. I make a big point in my book of the fact that there is no value-neutral knowledge. There is no objectively valid standpoint that doesn't have some living tradition at its basis. So heritage is terribly important, but there's a great deal of difference between having a dynamic relationship to an evolving tradition. There's a great deal of difference between that and static adherence to the customs of a relatively tribal and provincial culture. So in the archetype of Atlas, the king of Atlantis, we see humanity's quest for a world civilization that transcends the confines of traditional cultures, which is something that one has to do insofar as one is willing to pursue knowledge at any cost. Because, the more you know, the more you're going to have to call into question things that have been handed down by the forefathers and so forth. You're not going to be able to remain in an unreflective ritualistic culture. So in my development of the idea of Atlantic civilization, or you could even call it a new Atlantis, or a civilization in the image of the archetype of Atlas, I'm suggesting that technological science involves a kind of enframing of the entire world, an enmeshing of the world in a unified network, and the building of a single world picture that has a destructive effect on provincial, tribal cultures, on people who are dogmatically stuck in one or another tradition. And you can see this very clearly, for example, in the universalization of the metric system. I show how what some people might think is just an objectively more adequate, you know, more streamlined measurement system really tore apart the values of other cultures in Africa and China that were employing measuring systems embedded with their own cosmology or their own cultural values. So the spread of technological science has an inherent colonialism. And it's not something that ought to be overly lamented. The danger that it poses to human life, the danger that it poses of instrumentalizing our lives and alienating us, can be overcome insofar as we recognize that we are actively engaged in a modeling activity rather than forwarding some kind of an objective representation of the world. If we can recognize that we are working with atlases of the world, this can be very empowering. And so it also gives us a tremendous advantage, sort of eagle's eye view, over cultures that are locked into more provincial adherence to custom.
This is a very important point. I think really that's at the core of everything we've been talking about. We're really just kind of scraping the surface and kind of just detailing the aspects that will kind of piece all this together for people. But I do want to, I guess, give people a hint here before we take a break of where this is going. But what I would say, Jason, is that what you're talking about is not meant to be at all that somehow we should fear technology. Far from it. However, it's the aspect that these archetypal properties that you have been describing that is within us, if you will, have driven us to develop this kind of technology, immensely destructive technology as well, we should point out, and also that this has been largely unconscious, right? That that us turning away from what you dubbed the spectral has caused an unbalance, that the technology as well that we are now developing is kind of, well, really leading us to a kind of Atlantis on our own, right? And you've spoken about the responsibility that comes with developing technology like this. For one, of course, not handing it over to others that have not developed it, but also that we need to become conscious of what we are to do with all of this, right? Is that a fair assessment of the situation?
Yes, it's a daemonic power. And, you know, I use that term in its original Greek meaning. Daemon is the Greek word for what in the Latinate languages we call genius. But it's fair to hear demon in it. It's a daemonic power that we have over all of the other cultures in the world. It's not because technological science is objectively more adequate. It's because it's more powerful in its manner of organizing nature and presenting a world to people. I focus a whole chapter on the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in Japan, and the way in which this coupled with the Japanese assimilation of German thought in the preceding generation worked to completely reconstruct the psyche of the Japanese intellectual elite. It's a very acute case of Atlantic civilization encompassing and transforming a non-European culture. And of course, this may have something to do also with the fact that the Japanese had a connection to the Indo-European heritage through Buddhism, something that I talk about there.
Mm, yeah.
So maybe, you know, not every culture would have been affected in the same way. At any rate, it is a great example of the kind of destructive but also reconstructive forces that are at play here and that are really unique to our civilization and what gives it its globalizing force.
That's very, very interesting. Now, is there anything else you want to say here about Atlas as agency of inframing or anything else? I think there's Feyerbend has talked on the age of Protagoras as well, and this idea of Greek colonialism. Is there more you want to mention about this before we take a break?
Well, I'll just briefly mention that, you know, people often think of European colonialism in terms of the Spaniards or the French or British, these Renaissance or late Renaissance or early modern projects of European colonialism. But the first European colonialists were, of course, the Greeks. And the product of Greek colonialism was the city of Alexandria in Egypt, which was the beacon of knowledge to the entire classical world. You know, Athens and Rome, they were not the intellectual capital of the classical European world. That was a Greek colony established in Egypt by Alexander the Great and fostered by the Ptolemies. And in that age, Protagoras had this saying, which Feyerabend points to as emblematic of the spirit of Alexandrian colonialism, namely, man is the measure of all things. Well, this is very much, you know, in the spirit of the archetype of Atlas.
All right. Well, Jason, time is running away from us here, so and I do want to spend some time giving out some details about the book as well. So let's do that here. It's published by Arctos. That's really where people can go to pick up a copy. I believe it's on Amazon as well, if I'm not correct. Tell us where people should go and if you have any personal websites or anything like that set up for people.
Yeah, it's available on Amazon and it is published by Arctos. You can also get it from the Arctos website directly. And I would encourage people to go to the Facebook site for Prometheus and Atlas. The book does have its own Facebook page. Eventually, I'm going to set up my own YouTube channel and so forth. But for now, they can go to the page that Prometheus and Atlas has on Facebook. And it is available through both Amazon and Arctos.
I'll make sure to link that up to the Facebook page there. But it's a fascinating read, ladies and gentlemen. Incredibly important. As I said, we haven't really... We're starting to put this in context now in terms of what we're facing here and some of the important messages that Jason has in the book. So I definitely encourage everyone to, you know, pick up a copy and read more. And, you know, Jason has a very sharp mind and a lot of important ideas, I think, for our time that is within the book. So I definitely recommend it. But, yeah, Jason, we'll definitely talk more about your book here in the second segment. So we'll say thank you for the first one and we'll take a short break. So stay with us, everybody. We'll be right back with more. Do not miss the second hour as we continue our discussion with Jason Georgiani. We've had him lay out his thesis, if you will, in the first segment. And now in the second, we open it up a bit more to questions about what he's just explained to us. We're going to talk more about archaeofuturism, transhumanism, the role of Abrahamic religion in the future as the invasion is ongoing in Europe, and to put this in context of progress, change, and technological advancements, which are archetypal forces of Prometheus and of Atlas. If you want to hear more, go to our members' website, redicemembers.com, and check out the subscriptions, and join in for the second hour. Next up on the show, we have Dr. Andrew Joyce, that writes for the Occidental Observer. We have Andrew Fraser, author of The Wasp Question, and also Philip de Winter, the Flemish nationalist, to talk about the dire demographic situation in Belgium, especially when it comes to Islam. Stay tuned, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be right back with Jason Georgiani for the second segment. Interesting stuff. Definitely don't miss it. We'll be right back. Thank you so much for listening.